Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with John McManus, author of the book Fire and Fortitude, the U.S. Army in the Pacific War, 1941 to 1943. John, welcome to New Books Network.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Well, thanks for being on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Yeah, I am a military history professor. My title is Curator's Distinguished Professor, and I teach a range of military history courses at Missouri University of Science and Technology in Rolla, Missouri, which is part of the University of Missouri system. So one of the neat things that I get to do quite often, because I've written a number of books on the topic, is to bring my research to the classroom and see how fascinating, endlessly fascinating, American military history is, not just for an old guy like me, but for the younger generation too. And so I try to do research and write books with that in mind, and always in mind, I have in mind the sort of, you know, the average person and how they experience certainly war, but also the military. That's really, to a great extent, my focus.
What was it that led you to write a book about the U.S. Army in the Pacific War? Because that would, on the surface, seem to be a subject about which we have many books already.
Yeah, well, believe it or not, you know, we really don't. And that's a big part of what led me to this. As a World War II historian, of course, I'm pretty cognizant of the sort of figurative plowed ground that we have in studying particularly the American experience in World War II. For instance, I think the atomic bomb, you know, has been covered, you know, almost ad nauseum, certain aspects of the Battle of Normandy, so on and so forth. But the incredible thing to me was that when we look at the Pacific War, there's a kind of popular sense, at least in this country, that it was really the Navy's war and that the Marines did the ground fighting. And that just couldn't be farther from the truth. Actually, the Army did the vast majority of the ground fighting in the Pacific and the war against Japan. It had massive, you know, logistical responsibilities. It's an engineering problem to a great extent too, a problem of diplomacy, especially when you're talking about the mission to China. You know, so it was this incredibly rich, multivariate story that, believe it or not, had been really quite overlooked by historical posterity, and to create a kind of warped sense of what the American war was. Actually, the army that served in the Pacific Asia theater was the third largest army we've ever sent overseas to fight a war, behind only the European theater in World Wars I and II. 1.8 million American ground troops served in the war against Japan, and yet there is no single book until now that tells, I guess, what we've called the story of the Pacific Asia War through that lens. And I felt it was very important to kind of broaden our perspective of the American war in the Pacific and our context, while also making the point, I'm not at all minimizing or denigrating the role of the Marine Corps, quite the opposite, actually. But I'm hoping to just kind of broaden the lens and also kind of perhaps, you know, give us some lessons as to how the services work together, problems that arose at times and why that happened and when they did work together well, and all these kinds of things that I think remain very, very important all these decades later.
Well, I was thinking when you start your book, you begin that process by explaining the presence of the United States Army in the Pacific in 1941, just prior to the outbreak of the war. And as you explained, it was the Army had a very extensive presence in the Pacific in terms of not just being, say, in Hawaii at you know, the bases there, but they were in the Philippines. They had a fairly substantial presence throughout the entire region.
They really did, because as, you know, American interests began to gravitate in that direction from about, say, the late 19th century onward, certainly, obviously, that means sea power to a great extent. And obviously, we we all realize that in one glance at the map. When you look at the Pacific Ocean, you understand that, you know, obviously this is a naval war, as much as anything, and you're not getting an army anywhere without sea power. So, of course, I take that into account. But I'm also saying that, you know, as American economic influence and political influence grew in the region, well, so too did the ground army's presence. An example would be the sort of continued stationing and presence of the 15th Infantry Regiment in China for many, many years. You know, the best example, of course, you had mentioned is the Philippines, where we have a military force that is truly unique in American history. It's a colonial force. It's a Phil-American army, majority Filipino and minority American, designed to defend the archipelago for its impending independence, which, you know, the United States Senate and the Roosevelt administration had planned to give the Philippines by 1946. So you see this kind of, I think you could say, administrative and leadership muscle memory, in the sense of many of those who will end up leading American troops in the war against Japan had experience on the ground in the various places where they fought. An example I'd give you is Lieutenant General Joseph Stilwell, who had, of course, served many years in China before World War II. Douglas MacArthur being a prime example, too, of all his time in the Philippines. Robert Eichelberger, you know, the list goes on and on and on of people who had experience doing things in the places where they would eventually lead troops.
Mm-hmm. And it's also a presence in the Pacific that does a lot to shape Japanese considerations as to whether to go to war with the United States, because that presence in the Philippines was a big factor in their decision to attack the United States, because they were really concerned about what those forces in the Philippines would do.
Most definitely. What I compare the sort of Japanese viewpoint of the American presence in the Philippines, what I compare it to in my book is, it's for the Japanese, it's sort of like a bone in the throat. The Japanese have convinced themselves by the end of the 1930s that they are in an existential crisis because of their paucity of resources. You know, and obviously they're a growing industrial, military, and economic power. And for that, you need resources like oil and rubber and iron ore and all those good things that the Americans are much more blessed with than they, and the European colonial powers who had come on the scene before Japan had modernized in the late 19th century. So, from that point of view, the Japanese, particularly the Imperial Navy, are telling themselves, you know, there's all this stuff that we want to get access to in what was called the Dutch East Indies. Today it's Indonesia, but it was Dutch colonies then. And, you know, one glance at the map shows you that the Philippines stand between the Dutch East Indies and Japan. And so it's what's interesting about it, and it sort of, you can detect Japanese frustration. And by the way, in the book, I really try and portray the Japanese point of view, too, particularly the average soldier. I found a lot of really remarkable sources of diaries and whatnot that, you know, that Americans captured and translated. And it's just really, really fascinating. And anyway, so the Japanese are looking at this and saying, you know, we don't really want the Philippines per se, but we have to have them because we can't have the Americans, you know, with a presence there, because it'll completely destroy our sea lanes and our lines of communication. And so, you know, they kind of reluctantly invade the Philippines at the end of 1941. But of course, both sides had kind of seen that coming for the better part of almost two decades. And including, of course, the Filipinos, too. They're looking at this and hoping not to see war come to their shores, understandably. And so they end up, I won't say caught in the middle, because they're really pro-American largely. But, you know, they're kind of dragged into this you know, quasi-imperial struggle between the U.S. and Japan as well. So it's really a fascinating and, of course, tragic thing.
Hmm. How prepared was the U.S. Army in the Pacific in 1941? Because, you know, the focus of the popular of popular opinion in 1941 in the United States was on what was happening in Europe. Those were the headlines that were filling the newspapers and the airwaves every day. And you, by contrast, Pacific seemed to be have been something of an afterthought. Was it an afterthought for the military as well, or were they anticipating some sort of Japanese? You mentioned that they had been talking about it for two decades. Were they ready for some sort of Japanese onslaught, or were they perhaps not expecting it when it occurred?
They are nowhere near ready, though. If I guess in using the word they, I mean military planners. They have been, you know, thinking about the potential of this conflict, and I suppose by the middle of 1941, what some saw as the inevitability of it, but they're nowhere near prepared. And so that's a major theme that emerges in 1941 and 42, and it's quite tragic, and it affects to a great extent that Philo-American army. The lack of preparedness on the part of the United States means that the Philippines eventually are going to be doomed, and that has just a catastrophic, effect in a human sense on those who are cut off, killed, captured, starved, whatever it would be. So that army is just simply not prepared for war, nor really is the Navy. The Army Air Forces are not prepared. It's just it's a horrible, horrible thing. And, you know, though military planners had thought in terms of the war, the American people just simply in the 1920s and 30s did not want to pay for a strong military posture worldwide. I mean, that just simply was a non-starter, and particularly during the Depression in the 1930s, when people were wondering how they were going to put food on the table, they didn't want to hear about spending for weaponry, and certainly they didn't want to hear about any kind of military draft. Now, that had begun to change a little bit, of course, after the outbreak of World War II, and especially the fall of France, which is a bit of a wake-up call to the American public of the international threat looming. And so you see the first peacetime draft in 1940 barely passed and barely renewed in 1941. But, you know, you're talking about, I won't say too little too late, but, you know, these are measures that are not necessarily going to lead to preparedness overnight, unfortunately. So the Japanese are better poised for war. But of course, I think as we all know, that a longer war is not going to be to their advantage. And so they were hoping for some quick knockouts to grab the resources I mentioned a few moments ago, and then eventually be on par with the United States in terms of oil production and iron ore and so on and so forth. They were heavily dependent upon the U.S. for oil. It's hard to imagine that now, but they were in those days. But they wanted their own their own oil production and whatever. And they thought, well, we'll conquer and grab this resource-rich empire, and you know then we'll be on par with them. And the European colonial powers are in such dire straits because of the war in Europe and their general decline anyway, and the restiveness and hatred toward them on the part of many indigenous peoples, of course, the trappings of white colonialism and all this, the Japanese felt that they might be able to carve out an empire, have parity, and then perhaps negotiate some sort of end to the war in their favor. Of course, that's not what happens. By attacking the United States, they unified the United States, and that made the U.S. incredibly potent.
As you describe, though, in that attack on Pearl Harbor, the famous attack, the Japanese focus was upon American naval power, and you describe it, and I hadn't really thought about it this way, but I think I was really struck by how you put it, that attacking the army at Pearl Harbor was something of an afterthought.
It really was. I mean, what they wanted at Pearl Harbor was the Navy, the capital ships of the Navy, and everybody else was just in the way, and especially Army ground troops. Now, certainly they wanted to destroy some of the Army Air Forces, which you've got, you know, a couple hundred planes stationed there, like at Wheeler Field and whatnot, not too far from Battleship Row at Ford Island, where the heart of the fleet was stationed. But make no mistake, I mean, the main target for the Japanese is that line of battleships and the Pacific Fleet's carriers, if they could get them. Fortunately, they were not, you know, in the harbor that day. And they wanted to basically cripple the Pacific Fleet so that they would then have a free hand throughout much of the rest of the Pacific. And they don't necessarily cripple the fleet, but they certainly staggered it. And this did give them, I wouldn't say a free hand, but naval predominance for a time. So from the Army's perspective, at Pearl Harbor. And this is, you know, this was another thing. I mean, we've you know, historians did a lot on Pearl Harbor, and quite properly, it has tended to be through the lens of the Navy's point of view. So what I tried to do in this book is just give you a sense of what Pearl Harbor and the attacks that go on throughout the island of Oahu, not just at Pearl Harbor, but in Oahu, what that's like for the typical Army ground pounder, especially like 18 miles to the north at Schofield Barracks, where the 25th Infantry Division is stationed, and the Japanese are hitting a nearby airfield. And of course, then they're strafing the barracks too. And so what is that like? What's it like for an Army anti-aircraft gunner who's at the mouth of Pearl Harbor and you know, shooting at these planes there, or for these for the sort of ground security people you have around Wheeler Field or whatever? And that's one of the things I do, is I distinguish between, you know, the larger portion of the Army and the Army Air Force. Of course, the Air Force was part of the Army in World War II. It's weird to think of now. So I want to say clearly, my book is not covering the Air Force's part of it, though obviously this intersects with the story. So when I mentioned that number earlier of 1.8 million Army troops in the Pacific, that doesn't even take into account the Army Air Forces, which obviously was a, you know, a huge and important part of the American Armed Forces in the war. So there, you know, the Army Air Forces at Pearl Harbor and around Oahu are an ancillary target for the Japanese. The fleet is really what they want, and the casualty numbers reflect that. I mean, it's the Navy that really absorbs the bulk of the deaths, especially aboard USS Arizona, of course, and the woundings that day. However, you know, the Army ground troops were hit fairly hard too, and Army medics were heavily involved in dealing with the, you know, the terrible human cost of the attacks that day. And I go into this in quite a bit of depth, and including what is interesting to me, you know, in terms of the study of gender, Army nurses are there too. And, you know, all of a sudden they find themselves just immersed in this carnage of combat and trying to save these young men who don't even know what has hit them. And it's really quite a captivating story, though not always terribly pleasant.
You carry that examination of, you know, the role of women in the U.S. Army in the Pacific when you're talking about the Philippines. And whereas you could say that the Navy was the focus of the Japanese when they attacked Pearl Harbor, when they attacked the Philippines, the focus is primarily upon the Army and the Army Air Forces. And you, over several chapters, describe, you know, one of these real, you know, epic tragedies of American history, which is the plight of the American military in the Philippines, and then the suffering of the men who survived the Japanese invasion to go into captivity.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, this is an army that is just doomed, unfortunately. And the major reason they're doomed is that their sea power and air power are removed. The what was called the U.S. Navy's Asiatic Fleet, which basically meant a fleet based in the Philippines, had very little impact on the campaign in 1941 and 1942. The Army Air Forces absorb a staggering defeat when the Japanese get the jump on MacArthur and destroy a good bit of his aerial complement on the ground within about 2 days of the Pearl Harbor attacks. And so at that point, the Japanese can really kind of set the tone. They can invade wherever they want. They can reinforce. They can resupply better than can the Americans and the Filipinos. But the interesting twist to this whole thing, when you look at like the tactical fighting that takes place in 1941 and 42, once the Japanese have invaded, and you have this Phil-American army fighting, you know, the Japanese are really not getting the better of the Allies tactically. What ultimately they win because of starvation, because of starvation and hunger and disease that the Allied forces experience, because they're doomed, because they're penned into the Bataan. And I would say, you know, as many know, you know, I'm certainly what I hope is an honest critic of MacArthur. I mean, certainly had some good points, but one of the terrible errors he makes, besides losing his air force mostly on the ground, is that, you know, when he assumes control of these military forces before the war, he junks the what was called War Plan Orange, which was basically a plan to say, all right, we know you can't defend all the beaches of Luzon and other islands in the archipelago. You never have enough people and firepower to do that. So what we're going to do is we're going to retreat most of our army to Bataan, which is a rugged, beautifully defensible peninsula, which is opposite Manila Bay. And so as long as you hold Bataan, your enemy cannot really use Manila Bay and use the wonderful harbor of Manila and control the capital and whatever. And so they thought, all right, we'll hunker down here, we'll hold off, and then the United States Pacific Fleet will fight a decisive engagement with the Imperial Navy. They'll win it, and they'll be able to reinforce us, and then we'll turn the tide and we'll eject the invaders. And MacArthur said, well, that's too defeatist. We can defend at the waterline, and I'm junking that whole plan. And, of course, what happens once the Japanese invade, I mean, they go through these, you know, stretched out forces like the proverbial hot knife through butter. And so you end up in complete disarray logistically. And that's the point I'm making, is that MacArthur is able to extract his army and retreat most of it to Bataan, in part because he outnumbers the Japanese 2-1, and his soldiers are more than a match at a combat tactical level for the Japanese. What they can't match is the logistics, because now your supply nodes are all over Luzon rather than collected in Bataan. And what that means then for you as a soldier is by January 42, you're on half and quarter rations, and there's no way that the army can sustain itself there. And so it's really a catastrophic error that is costly on many, many levels.
And yet, even though they know this in January of 1942, you don't have the final surrender at Corregidor for another 4 months.
Right. And it speaks to, you know, several things. You know, in modern warfare, it's always easier to defend than attack, certainly, and especially when you have good defensible ground, which Bataan offers you. So the Japanese really have a heck of a time trying to overcome Allied defensive lines that are pretty well manned with a decent amount of firepower. And you know, these troops fight very hard. So there's that. The Japanese are outnumbered. They, too, end up with some logistical problems. They end up with problems like of disease. They have medical issues. And, of course, the Allies are dealing with that, too. You know, the Phil American Army is large, and it is committed to holding out as best they possibly can. So that's one of the things that I think many of them will resent for the rest of their lives. They feel they were able to hold out for a pretty good amount of time, but they were, in essence, abandoned. Well, here we come back to the theme of unpreparedness, because now you have a United States that's involved in a global conflict and having to make very difficult strategic priority decisions. And, of course, priority had gone to Europe by that point in time, and MacArthur was an adamant opponent of that and would be his entire life. And you know, there were a number of Americans who felt the same way. I mean, they were angry at Japan, and they didn't necessarily understand what the beef was with Germany. So from that point of view, you know, these guys in the Philippines are saying, hey, we need help. You know, you come and rescue us. And they felt like they were just sort of cast out and abandoned. And in a larger sense, too, they felt like they had, like the country had broken its compact with its former colony, the Philippines, that the Americans had a responsibility to the Filipinos, you know, to help save them. And so this is certainly something MacArthur will argue his entire life. But, yeah, you end up with, of course, these monumental tragedies. There's two major surrenders, one on Bataan in April 1942. And there's such an interesting kind of historical closing the loop or parallel here. The commander who has to surrender is Major General Edward Ned King. Interesting guy, because he's a Southerner who's been reared in the sort of Confederate tradition, and yet he rails against racism and against sort of racial condescension. And the first thing he tells his officers when they're stationed in the Philippines, and this is before the war, he says, there's no such thing as racial superiority or racial distinctions, and I want you to all operate that way here in the Philippines, you know, looking at everybody as an equal person. And yet, when he surrenders, it's on the same day, the anniversary of the same day that Lee had surrendered to Grant at Appomattox, not that long before, whatever, 70-some-odd years. And that was all that could go through King's mind, was Lee's famous quote, you know, that I will go see General Grant and I would rather die 1,000 deaths. And he's saying to himself, I'll go see General Hammond, I'd rather die 1,000 deaths, you know. So, of course, then that leads to the terrible and infamous Bataan Death March, which hits the Filipinos significantly worse than the Americans. The Americans was about 600 dead, Filipinos maybe as many as 10,000. And that's a theme, you know, that you're going to see when they're in captivity. Corregidor surrenders on May 6th. And that, you know, so if you were someone who surrendered at Corregidor, you would not have been in the Bataan Death March. So you would have had it a little bit better in that regard, though obviously this was not going to be a good situation for anybody. But those who were in the Bataan Death March were those who surrendered at Bataan in April 1942. The guy who surrenders at Corregidor is another fascinating story, Jonathan Wainwright, because he's the son of a cavalryman. He's a passionate cavalryman himself. He loved horses. He was the grandson of a naval officer who was killed in the Civil War, the nephew of a naval officer who was killed fighting pirates. So this is a man steeped in the military tradition. And when MacArthur is ordered out by FDR, it's Wainwright who then has this mess on his hands as to how to carry on. And he himself then is going to endure 3+ years of terrible captivity, he is the highest ranking United States Army officer ever taken prisoner, and, you know, has to deal with beatings and mental torture and you name it. Jonathan Skinny Wainwright is a remarkable individual on a lot of levels. And so I've tried to sort of convey this partially through his point of view too, but obviously the point of view of so many of his soldiers.
You make this fascinating point that I had never really considered, which is while he's undergoing that physical torture and he's undergoing that mental torture, he's also emotionally torturing himself. You mentioned how, you know, throughout this experience, he's convinced that he has gone down as, you know, this incredible, as this great failure, that they ranks right up there with all the, you know, the failed military commanders in American history. And he's not aware that, you know, back at home, he is being lionized as being as this brave hero who withstood the Japanese for as long as he could. I mean, you're seeing all the celebration, a celebration that, as you mentioned, MacArthur himself more than a little resented.
Most definitely. And it's a fascinating study into, you know, how mindset can change depending on events and who is the key influencer. MacArthur, if you look at his statements for the first year or two after the surrender in the Philippines, he does not view Wainwright very well, and he takes steps to try and make sure Wainwright does not get the Medal of Honor. MacArthur will pursue this kind of sort of fatuous, what else would I call it? Like contention throughout at least the early part of the war, that he only left the Philippines, you know, certainly under order of the president, and that's correct. But he only left so that he could go to Australia and come immediately back with a military force to, you know, turn back the Japanese tide and to save the situation. And I've always felt that that's just sheer sophistry, because if the military situation was bad enough that they couldn't get help to you before and that you were going to be evacuated, there was no way on earth you were going to have the resources to come back and reinvade the Philippines and attack and do that so quickly. So I believe that someone as intelligent as MacArthur knew full well that, you know, he was leaving and then they were pulling the plug on this thing. And so in that sense, I mean, what else could Wainwright do? But he had tried to tell Wainwright, well, I expect you to struggle on and not to surrender and all this. And then he's like, okay, pursue guerrilla warfare and all this. And, you know, these are all things that were just, you know, near to impossible at that stage for Wainwright to supervise. So eventually, though, as time goes on and people in this country began to understand what Wainwright faced and began to understand a bit more about what captivity at the hands of the Japanese really meant, the true horror that actually was. 37% of the Americans who ended up in captivity of the Japanese did not survive. And so as people began to understand that, Wainwright did emerge as a major hero. And as that happens, of course, MacArthur realizes, I'm working against the, the major tide of public opinion, and General Marshall and the administration are very pro Wainwright and all that. So yeah, Wainwright eventually will of course emerge in the public mind as one of the great heroes of the war, but he doesn't know that. He's operating as a vacuum in captivity. I mean, he's like any good commander. He thinks about the mistakes he made and he laments having to surrender and all that. But you know, then he kind of focuses on, well, this is what's in front of me. He's trying to get my guys through this terrible experience of captivity the best I can. And Wainwright will really excel at that. The more adversity that they face, the better his leadership. He's a tragic figure though, too, because he's certainly never the same. He'd always had alcohol problems. It was said that, on a cavalry maneuver, he could go through a fifth of whiskey in the space of less than a day, you know, but never really seemed drunk. After the war is when his drinking got worse, because you know, he had a lot of emotional baggage, a lot of things to deal with. The dealing with celebrity too was difficult for him, for a man this modest. So Wainwright is a tragic figure in some ways, but I think also an inspirational figure too.
So the Army loses its major bastion in the Pacific, and they're now faced with the challenge of fighting the war in other areas. And you focus on one of those key areas, which is China. And China is not something that often gets into the narrative of the American experience in World War II. But as you explain, they make a fairly concerted effort to aid the Chinese in their ongoing war against Japan.
Most definitely. And this is the thing that's fascinating about it. From some point of view, including maybe all these decades later, China really is the key to the whole war. Not as much the European theater or whatever. Of course, at the time, priority goes to Europe. And even within the war against Japan, China is seen as a kind of ancillary theater. And of course, the British don't really want to be involved there much. They couldn't care less about the rise of a kind of independent, nationalistic pro-Western China or whatever. The British wanted to continue their empire, and China could threaten that. So Churchill wanted to invest no resources, but really, from the military point of view at the time, China was absolutely vital, because for whatever Chiang Kai-shek's many, many, many problems of his regime, his continued existence was tying down a lot of Japanese military manpower on the Asian continent, and also the existence of Mao Zedong's communist forces in the north, which did very little fighting. But again, just their existence was creating problems for the Japanese. And the Japanese are dealing with guerrilla warfare, really a lot of issues in China. So as long as that was the case, that meant these guys were not available to fight American forces elsewhere in the Pacific. And that mattered. So, you know, when we look at the war in Europe, we're always struck by the fact that Hitler embraced a two-front war, and much to his detriment, of course. Well, the Japanese actually did the same thing. The army got its war on the Chinese in China and the Asian mainland for resources and influence and empire, and out of a series of major screw-ups and whatever that you know, are sort of beyond the scope of what we're just discussing today. But also the Navy gets its war against the U.S. and the Western powers to grab the resources in the Pacific and whatever else. So Japan is constantly struggling with trying to deal with a war that's larger than it can handle. And so in that context, the Americans find it vital to keep Chiang Kai-shek afloat. And the way to do that is to send Stilwell there as a kind of military mission and advisor. So you don't have a lot of American ground troops there. You have some, but you don't have combat troops until 1944. So it's mainly a logistical proposition and a diplomatic proposition and a kind of intel thing, where you're helping keep that regime afloat. And you're hoping to supply them. And of course, when the Japanese take Burma in 1942, it cuts off a land supply route. So you're having to supply them via airlift. And then the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Stilwell become fixated on
retaking northern Burma and having a land route, a road into China. And so now what's fascinating about that, and I talk about this in the book, once you're seeing that North Burma campaign in 1943, it's now an engineering proposition. Imagine yourself having to build a road, a long, like, interstate-style highway through some of the world's thickest wilderness and some of the highest ground you could ever imagine, and just in a completely remote place with no infrastructure of any kind, in which you have no, you know, institutional memory of any kind. And yet this is what the Americans and their allies are going to do. And what's interesting about it from a socio-cultural perspective here is about two-thirds, a little less than two-thirds, of the engineers who begin to work on what's called the Lido Road or eventually the Stillwell Road are African-American, and, you know, serving in segregated units, sometimes under white officers, not always, working alongside white engineering units, Indian laborers, Chinese engineers, a few British in this, and some Burmese in this incredible kind of multicultural stew of creating this engineering marvel, all for the purpose of keeping China in the war, which the British see as ancillary, but I think the Americans understand much better the incredible importance of China. And of course, we look at it now all these decades later. I think it's fair to say that, you know, the outcome of the ultimate struggle in China, not just between the Chinese and the Japanese, but within China, between Chiang Kai-shek and the communists, the outcome has set the tone for all subsequent history. It's what, in my view, personally, one of the great tragedies in human history, that the communist triumph. It leads to two subsequent American wars on the Asian continent, Korea and Vietnam. And I think it's fair to say that our current situation and relations are, you know, not exactly ideal and optimum either. So all this matters greatly. And I think in a way, much more so than whatever we're doing in North Africa at the time, or Sicily or something, though, you know, obviously those are important and fascinating events, but in terms of long-term impact, what happens in China matters a lot.
And yet it doesn't get anywhere near the coverage as the American experience in Europe.
It doesn't. And I think that's one of the things I try and redress a little bit is, okay, what's it like for these Americans who are now on the ground in China? And of course, it's not as if Americans had no ties or history there. Of course they did. And there was, of course, a China lobby in this country that tries to steer resources to China and whatever else. But we can see this American experience through the eyes of Stillwell, who is, I don't think you'll ever see an officer, a commander, a leader, whatever, who is so ideally suited for the job and so incredibly poorly suited for the job. You don't often see that. It's actually incredible. I mean, he has almost two decades of experience on the ground in China. He speaks Mandarin Chinese. He can read Mandarin Chinese. He has relationships, you know, that he's had for a long time, including with Chiang Kai-shek. I mean, he knows the people. He loves the country. He is a fighter, a first and foremost fighter. He's incredibly honest. He has all these great qualities, but he's so honest that he can't stand the corruption and the Byzantine scheming and the politics and all the stuff that goes on in Chiang Kai-shek's retinue and also in his nationalist regime, which is to some extent nothing more than a sort of cobbled together group of alliances with local power brokers and whatever else. And of course, he grows to have complete contempt for Chiang Kai-shek, and he's so honest that he can't keep his opinion to himself, and so it deteriorates his relations. He struggles with the aviation side because he and Claire Chennault, the American air commander, just can't get along. They have completely different strategic visions for China, and Chennault gets along much better with Chiang Kai-shek and his family than does Stillwell. The China theater is really quite fascinating in terms of human interplay and the consequences of personality and leadership. And I really try to bring that to light in the book, that you see, you know, the upsides and the downsides of Stillwell. One of the things I try to resist is sort of black or white analysis kind of thing. You know, this guy's all good or all terrible or whatever. No, there were nuances to this. And we know a lot more about Chiang Kai-shek than we used to. partially because of his diary, but other newer primary sources. And, you know, so I think that historians have a little bit better view of him than they did even maybe 20 or 30 years ago. And so all of that contributes, I hope, to a kind of latter year look at this to say, you know, okay, well, here were the upsides and the downsides. Here were the mistakes. You know, and maybe you decide what you think could have been done better. Maybe the reader can decide for himself or herself. And, you know, after you see these events play out, but I think what we might all agree upon is the importance of this when we think about it like this, but also just the how interesting the whole story is.
You mentioned that the United States Army would not fight in China until 1944. That doesn't mean, though, that they're not fighting the theater. In fact, what they're beginning to do practically from even before the Philippines fall is they start this buildup in Australia to go after Japan directly through the South Pacific. And you have a chapter which describes not that, you know, that battle with Japan that comes up a little bit later, but you describe this fascinating interplay between Americans and these native Australians. You describe it's more of a social history of these Americans who are for the first time, many of whom for the first time are traveling abroad in a country that is at the one time is simultaneously both very familiar and also very alien as well.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, when we think about American allies in World War II, I mean, of course, the famous one is with the British. And of course, the incredible impact that Americans have in Britain and all that, that's pretty well plowed ground. We know a lot about that. And yet here is this discourse in Australia that I think has been, I wouldn't say ignored by historians, but just incredibly overlooked in our own kind of myopic American way. I think many of us have just sort of breezed past the Australian role in the war, which is absolutely vital, especially in 1942 and 43. When the Australians are thinking in terms of defending their homeland against a possible Japanese invasion, and they need American help, but in terms of combat readiness of ground forces, the Australians are farther along than we are. And, you know, so they're going to do some of the harder fighting earlier on. But of course, now Australia is going to have to become, for say this first year and a half, almost 2 years of the Pacific War, the base for the Western allies, in much the same way, obviously, Britain becomes the base in Europe. And of course, now this means the kind of social interaction that you'd really hardly ever had before. About a million Americans are either stationed or passed through Australia in the course of World War II. I mean, think of the effect of that. One example is on the racial side. Australia is formed with what was called the White Australia Policy. And that meant that anyone coming to Australia to live or work there for any given time had to be white. And this just was not going to fly when you're talking about a multicultural U.S. Army, albeit segregated on the basis of race. Nonetheless, a lot of the units we were going to bring in Australia to help develop the infrastructure, the roads were like incredibly primitive and the railroads were by American standards. And all that need to change. And some of this is going to have to be done by African-American units. And the Americans saying, no, we've got to have these units come in here. And the Australians eventually relent. The irony of the whole thing, you would think, okay, the reception for the African-American units is going to be really hostile. Actually, no. The average person in Australia had very good relations with black soldiers. And the main problems they're going to have is with their fellow white soldiers who are trying to bring, you know, hardcore Jim Crow segregation to the armed forces in Australia, too. And so you end up with competition over women, you know, the same old story there that you see in other portions of the globe. So that you see the tensions among the Americans on display in front of our allies. In addition, though, too, you see a theme that would have been quite familiar, you know, like to you if you were British or if you were Italian or French or Belgian or wherever, you know, elsewhere in this war, the Americans have come in, their soldiers have come in with a lot more money, a lot better uniforms, a lot more glamour, and they're just irresistible to local women, you know, and so there's a lot of resentment over that. There's resentment over the Americans driving too fast. I know that's hard to imagine. the Americans, you know, with their kind of largesse and their
their breeziness, and but also the kind of, it's quite interesting. I look at this, I try to present the Australian point of view too. The difficulty of understanding the different American accents and, the sort of mini American cultures within the larger U.S. culture. There's of course, a lot of war brides that come out of this, about 10,000 Australian war brides. And, you know, since you're talking about a group of people this large, you're going to have some criminal problems too. I mean, we've got rapes, we've got thievery, and we even have a serial killer, a guy named Edward Leonsky, who kills three Australian women before he's finally apprehended by the local authorities. So we end up with MacArthur's command ends up with a very tense situation with the locals as to what we're going to do with Leonsky and how we're going to prosecute him and all of this. And it's, the tragic thing is that when you look into his history, you could see that he had problems even before he was deployed overseas. And if someone would have just stepped in and said, wait a minute, we're not going to send this guy, he's got issues. He had assaulted women here in the U.S. The whole thing could have been prevented. But, things like that could have sabotaged the relationship even before it began. But there's a larger theme that I try and stress, which is that this sort of Australian-American partnership and friendship, I'll call it too, that emerges from 1942 onward, and I would say has never changed ever since. It's really when you see the modern relationship between these two countries begin during World War II.
And yet that relationship, as you explain, was not an easy one, and that was especially true on the battlefield, because when you have the United States dealing with the initial campaign into, say, New Guinea, the Japanese are attacking there, the United States forces have to work with the Australians, and especially early on, it's not a good fit between the two, and you describe that primarily in terms of the command level.
Right, and at this point in the war, MacArthur is a very, I think it's fair to say, kind of narrow-minded commander in terms of cooperation and unity. Now, he worked with the Filipinos well, make no mistake, and that's partially because he loved the people there so much and had such an affinity and bond with the country. But I will say, he comes away from the Philippines and that experience, bad experience, of course, thinking, well, the Navy's useless. Because the Asiatic fleet had not helped him, and he figured it had just scattered to the winds, and he comes away thinking the Army Air Forces are useless too. And okay, these were disastrous opinions. I mean, completely wrong. That fortunately, to his credit, he will begin to amend, and partially because of the good relationships he will consummate with Admiral William Halsey. This is a lesser known thing, that Halsey and MacArthur's fathers had known each other and had worked together. So MacArthur and Halsey, the sons, end up forging an incredibly productive partnership. And it kind of, Halsey and the relationship with him sort of rehabilitates the Navy in MacArthur's mind, which obviously that partnership was of vital importance, of course. And the Army Air Forces are rehabilitated in MacArthur's eyes by George Kenney, who becomes a really rather remarkable air commander through the rest of the war. Well, so too, MacArthur has formed this opinion of the Australians as just kind of backward and not professional. And so he has really neglected his ties with General Blamey, General Herring, several of the other key Australian commanders. And you're seeing this play out in New Guinea, in which the coordination isn't good, in which MacArthur has this kind of condescending attitude toward Australian military forces, which is just plain wrong. The Australian military forces were really, really good, and they're fighting better than the Americans, frankly. And so at this point, MacArthur is going down the wrong path. And I think one of the people who helps sort of put him back on a straighter path is his key command subordinate, ground commander, Lieutenant General Robert Eichelberger, who is thrown into the mix in New Guinea and then begins to forge better relationships, better partnerships with the Australian commanders, particularly General Herring, with whom they form a brother-like bond. And I think there's a very good message there of understanding, you know, that you're never going to agree on everything. You're always going to have differences as allies. But in the end, you're friends and partners for a reason, and you have to find good ways to work together. The Americans and Australians will eventually do that.
But unfortunately, at the beginning of the relationship, and really it's more the Americans' fault than the Australians, they were working across purposes, especially in the New Guinea campaign.
And it didn't help that the conditions of the campaign were some of the most arduous of the war. I mean, you described the logistical issues. They were having to literally, you know, carry supplies on their backs to get to the battlefield, that they're having to, you know, coordinate between not just the Australians, but the native Papuans who are, you know, have a war effectively thrust upon them. And they're fighting a Japanese enemy, which, while, you know, they're facing a lot of the same conditions, are much better situated and prepared to defend themselves than the Americans are to attack them.
At that point, yeah, like in say November 1942, that's precisely the situation. The conditions there are beyond belief. There's no good place to fight a war. But if I'm going to fight a war, I don't know about you, but I'd rather it be, you know, like 75 degrees and comfortable San Diego type weather.
we need more wars in Southern California is what you're saying.
Right. But New Guinea is like the worst place you could ever choose. It's, you know, in the 90s and humidity is high, tropical diseases like you wouldn't believe. You know, practically look at the place and you have malaria or yellow fever. There's terrain like you wouldn't believe with, the Owen Stanley Mountains. Some of the peaks range to 10,000 feet high. You have rivers and gorges and no infrastructure, no roads. I mentioned earlier the Burma wilderness. Well, the Papua New Guinea wilderness is really even worse. And you know, all these little, just a few little trails through the jungle if you're lucky. But even then, you know, just to move across the island, say 80 miles, is nearly impossible. And this is where, you know, General Kenny, who I mentioned earlier, comes into play by saying to MacArthur, hey, you know what? I think it might make more sense to airlift troops across all this terrain rather than have them try and arduously work their way over months. And we can get them across in 45 minutes. You know, and MacArthur's like, you know what? That makes sense. But the problem is once you get there to the north coast of New Guinea, which the Japanese are trying to hold on to, you know, they're very, as you said, they're very well dug in and entrenched, coconut log bunkers and this kind of thing. And a lot of it's just swamp. So any traversable terrain is heavily covered with weapons. You don't have much artillery. You don't have too much airstrike support. You don't have much naval support at this stage. It's an infantryman's fight, and it's a small unit kind of thing. And the thing that I try and emphasize in the book is this Papua New Guinea campaign, what we often call BUNA, because that's the sort of lodestone of it from an American point of view, the place where most of the fighting happens, is an inextricably linked to the Battle of Guadalcanal, which is way more famous and is associated, I think, improperly and incorrectly solely with the Marines. Well, yes, the Marines did major fighting in Guadalcanal, but alongside the Army. And so the reason that I try and intersperse these two stories, you know, at the risk of losing the narrative thread, which I hope I don't, but is because they are two chapters of the same book in that sense. And the Japanese certainly saw it that way. And it's one of the reasons why they lose, because they had stretched their resources then fighting on Guadalcanal at the same time they're trying to fight for Papua New Guinea. And this was fatal to them. And one of the reasons why the Allies win was the Australian role in New Guinea, not really on Guadalcanal, but on New Guinea, alongside the Americans in fighting for those enclaves in the northern coast. Once the Allies have them, it allows them to have the initiative to advance across the northern coast of New Guinea, which, of course, is a major undertaking. It will take a long time. But that's when you see the turning of the tide in this war. And especially at Buna is where you see the United States Army ground combat forces start to come of age in the Pacific War.
It's one of the things that I was really struck by as I was reading your book, which is the sheer range of conditions in which the Army had to fight. I mean, you're talking about these incredibly arduous tropical conditions. They're having to deal, you know, with Burma, as you mentioned. They have to deal with New Guinea. They also, though, have to fight in this incredibly cold climate of Alaska, because you have the Japanese having seized Attu and Kiska as part of their feint during the Midway operation. They have this presence on American soil, American territory at this point, not an American state. But you do have this need to drive them out. And while the climate is very different and the miseries in that respect are very different, you as you point out, they face a lot of the same logistical challenges. They're having to go to a place with even less infrastructure than Australia, with even less infrastructure than Burma, and prepare for a significant assault against a prepared Japanese position.
Right, and a very committed Japanese force that is hoping to be reinforced, and specifically at Attu, which is just a forlorn place. And you would think, okay, it's up there in the Aleutians, it's up, you know, there in Alaska, way, way up north, it must be like minus 20 degrees or something and cold. No, the wind forces, in at least in the spring, in the early summer, created more like a climate similar to like winter would be in England kind of thing. Just rainy and sort of misty and foggy and miserable and sort of like 38 to 45 degrees and muddy and miserable. And there was this aspect of the terrain on Attu called the Muskeg, and it was like a marsh, like a swampy, like I talked about swamps in New Guinea. Well, this is the same kind of thing, just in a colder climate. And it's marshy terrain, which meant that vehicles were going to get bogged down. There's no roads really to speak of. And it meant for you as a soldier, now just, you know, moving 100 to 200 yards becomes very difficult because you're constantly in this muck, trying to move across, and it's eating up a lot of your energy and, of course, making you more vulnerable. Now you've also got ridge lines and some pretty major hills and mountains where the Japanese are entrenched. So the 7th Infantry Division goes in there in May 1943 and fights a rather hellacious kind of close quarters battle with the Japanese, a Japanese garrison that had thought that it might be reinforced, but it wasn't because of U.S. naval victories. And because the Japanese High Command had decided, we don't really want to be in Alaska after all. We've got other more important things to deal with by this point in the war, and they've written these poor guys off. So they're doomed, but they're going to fight to the death, as Japanese were wont to do in that war. So the 7th Division suffered proportionally the highest casualties for U.S. ground combat force until the Battle of Iwo Jima, 2+ years later, that is primarily a Marine Corps battle. So, yeah, I have a whole chapter on Attu, which I think we unfortunately tend to forget, but it's technically U.S. soil that these guys are liberating. And there's sort of tragic, sort of, at least from a career point of view, sort of subplot to this whole thing, that the division commander gets relieved by officers who are never even on Attu. They're hundreds of miles away. They don't know really what's going on, but they're just like, it ought to be going quicker there. Let's get rid of him. And, you know, and the irony too is as soon as they get rid of him, then the situation begins to turn around quickly, mainly because of the leadership and decisions that this guy, General Brown, took. So you see this war is grinding people up in a very serious way in terms of woundings and killings and the tragedy of all that. But it's also just, it's so ruthless that it's, you know, there's this mindset of these military professionals who have, you know, dedicated their lives to this, and just these little twists and turns that aren't even their fault can just destroy their careers kind of thing, too. It's just it just gives you a sense of the ruthlessness of World War II.
You end the book by describing the invasion of Makin Island. And this is another example of how you have an army involvement in the Pacific War that tends to get overshadowed by the more famous marine operations, in this case, the invasion of Tarawa. And yet it's very interesting because it seems that, and it was really interesting to consider it this way, the idea of Makin is where the army is starting to find its footing, and you're starting to see the patterns that are going to play out in for the remainder of the war in terms of the army's engagement in the Pacific, an invasion of an island, the sort of operations they're going to face there, and how the army is starting to really master the challenges of fighting the war in this theater.
Yeah, the army is becoming, by the end of 1943, a maturing amphibious force. And one of the points that I make in this and the follow-up volume is that when it comes to the amphibious invasions, the army carries out most of them in the Pacific theater. You know, the Marines have 15 throughout the entire war. And one army alone, like the 8th Army in the spring of 1945 in the Philippines, carries out 35. So, you know, you end up in the fall of 1943, you're starting to see an island hopping campaign in which the Americans are hoping to grab air bases, you know, on this eventual advance to Japan. So you've seen sort of two prongs emerge, mainly through an uneasy kind of compromise between Army and Navy leaders. MacArthur's Southwest Pacific area, this advance across New Guinea with the eventual goal of getting back to the Philippines, and then Admiral Chester Nimitz, his command of the sort of island hopping in the Central Pacific. And this takes us to the Gilbert Islands, where we feel that at the Tarawa Atoll, there are key air bases we have to continue to advance. So there's two key islands that have to be invaded: the island of Baishio, where the 2nd Marine Division is most famously going to invade, and we just simply call that Tarawa after the atoll, and of course it's an infamous battle. It's one of the very, very few battles in the history of the Marine Corps that's exclusively Marine Corps. There's that. There's Iwo Jima, and there's one other. But in most cases, it's the Army and the Marines fighting shoulder to shoulder. Well, in a larger sense of this operation, you have the 27th Infantry Division invading a nearby island called Macon. That's part of the same atoll. It's not as heavily defended, but it's a, you know, it's a sharp 4-day fight in which, if you're one of those soldiers, and I you know, try to describe this very vividly, you're basically dealing with people who are like dug into these bunkers and tank traps and fortified trench lines. They're not particularly well-trained defenders, but they don't have to be, you know. I mean, it doesn't really take much to, for somebody who's committed to fight to the death, to just hunker down and to spray an automatic weapon or throw grenades or whatever and take as many Americans out as he can. And so you've got to be mindful of that as you attack. So that's, it's a, the Army is going to, you know, try and minimize casualties, as is sort of the Army's way. But at the same time, have an act on taking this ground. So you see by the end of this, and I think by the end of the book, then you start to see some of the emerging tension between the Army and the Marine Corps in terms of how they fight sometimes, or at least how their leaders say they fight. Now, the Army a bit more deliberate with combined arms, the Marines a little bit more like direct assault to grab an objective sooner. But also, you know, the kind of different individual training that leads you into to become a Marine infantry versus Army infantry. In the end, I argue in this book and in the next one that they really have way more in common than otherwise, but still you do see some of the differences in tension there. The interesting thing too about the Army division that attacks Macon, it's a New York National Guard unit, the 27th Infantry Division, or the Orion Division. So it features the best and worst of that. You know, the worst could be people who are just kind of political cronies who don't have much military ability. The best of that is they're more connected with the population too, in some ways. So I think overall the 27th was a really good solid unit, but it's going to eventually tangle with some of the Marine commanders later on, not just at Macon.
Well, you mentioned the command structure they face there, where you have a superior officer, Holland Smith, who's a Marine, and he really doesn't have a formal place in the hierarchy, but he comes along and he's there basically sniping Ralph Smith, who's the Army commander, and criticizing what he's trying to do. And as you explain, you know, Ralph Smith is doing a pretty good job, you know, considering this is, you know, his first invasion, his first campaign of the war. And yet, in spite of that, you have Holland Smith, who is kind of riding him to fight it more the way that he would like to fight it.
Right. One of the themes I really explore a lot is, you know, military leadership, senior leadership, and the effect of personalities on great events and battles and whatever. You see almost immediately a personality conflict between Ralph Smith and Holland Smith. They're wired very differently. Ralph Smith was thoughtful, introspective, a very committed military professional. He was probably, I would say, one of the Army's 3, 4, 5 foremost experts on France He had fought in World War One. He'd seen a lot of combat alongside the French. He spoke French fluently. And so naturally, the Army sends him to the Pacific. I just think that's hilarious. It's so Army. So, but this happens because, you know, they just didn't have a division available at that point, you know, for him to lead in Europe. And they weren't fighting in France yet. And they needed a quality officer to command the 27th Division, you know. So this is the way it shook out. So Ralph Smith had seen a lot of combat. He understood a lot about small unit infantry tactics. He'd learned a lot about amphibious warfare. Holland Smith is, to me, I think he represents one of the few weaknesses in the Marine Corps, in the sense that some of the people who acquired senior leadership in that war had no business being in that position. Holland Smith was the son of an Alabama lawyer who had become a lawyer himself and didn't like it much. And he's kind of casting about looking for something else to do. He, ironically enough, considering his later attitudes, he tried to join the Army as an officer. They didn't have any commission slots at that point. And so they say, how about the Marine Corps? And he's like, well, what's the Marine Corps? So he basically just gets a commission. He didn't go through the Naval Academy, as many Marine officers did. He didn't go through intense training like OCS, like you would nowadays. He gets his commission. He doesn't see a lick of combat, but he does acquire some pretty impressive knowledge on amphibious warfare. But he has this kind of personality flaw in which he has this chip on the shoulder that the other services are always trying to destroy the Marine Corps. And so he's always kind of at war with the Navy and with the Army, and he becomes convinced that the Army soldiers don't fight like Marines. And he's already sort of badgering to this effect at Macon. But what's frustrating for him, he doesn't really have any command authority. So he's like a titular head there in the Gilberts, and he knows this terrible battle is happening at Tarawa, and he cares deeply for his Marines, as you'd expect that he would. He knows that's going on, and at the same time, he wants Macon done too, and so he's putting pressure on Ralph Smith, and then he comes up, he's just not someone with any kind of filter. So he comes up with and makes contentions to the media that are just simply not quite true, or they're half true, or they're distorted. And so he becomes this kind of loose cannon. And you see the foundation set for some pretty major personality problems that are going to lead to real issues between the Army and the Marine Corps. And I think it's very unfortunate. And so I tend to interpret it more as an example of problems caused by even one sort of subpar senior leader, what can happen there, versus real institutional issue between the Army and the Marine Corps. Because what you're going to see throughout most of the war is enormous respect between the average Marine rifleman and the average Army infantryman, tremendous respect and rapport there, and comradeship. And most of the time, really good coordination and leadership when you have different people than Holland Smith involved. And so to me, that becomes the separator. So, but you're already seeing that at Macon and Tarawa is Holland Smith's, what I view personally, negative effect on the relationship.
Well, you've already mentioned that you are talking about the next volume. How's it coming along?
It's coming along very well. I've been working extremely hard on it for the last almost couple of years, and we're hoping to have it out maybe by the end of next year. But, you know, I don't know that that timetable is set in stone or how our current world situation affects any of that. But at least that's the tentative plan. But as we always know, plans don't always survive first contact with the enemy, I guess.
Well, I hope that when it does come out, that we can have you back on the podcast to talk about that book as well.
Absolutely. I would love to. Yeah. And in that one, you'll really see a bit more development of Robert Eichelberger, whom I talk about quite a bit in this one, in Fire and Fortitude, especially in relation to the Battle of Buna. And I view him as really perhaps the most proficient American ground combat commander at the sort of three-star command and above in this war. He's in the conversation, in my view, and you'll see this play out in some of the 1944 and 45 campaigns as well.
Well, I do look forward to reading about that, and I, like I said, I do hope we can have you back when you've published the book. John McManus, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. It's been a true pleasure.